You're listening to Building the Game with Rob and Jason.
It's Building the Game with Jason and Rob. For tabletop game design, you really can't go wrong. Building the Game, yeah, Building the Game.
Hello and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, July 4th, 2016. You're listening to episode 214. My name is Rob. Mr. Jason Slingerland is over there, about to light off some fireworks.
Just actually proud that you didn't biff the intro for the first time in a very long time.
It's the 4th of July. It's, you know, there's other things for us to do.
It is on the 4th of July, yes. So
yeah, you're not actually going to light some fireworks because we're recording this in advance and it's not that kind of day.
I am going to light fireworks, though, on the 4th of July.
Well, so am I.
I mean, maybe.
I'm going to blow my freaking hand off, man. I can't wait.
Poor choice. But no, my plan is to light some fireworks off. We're going to use the side street over here and just set them up. Then I have to mess with my driveway.
You don't have to clean it up.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to clean it up.
On the public property.
I'll just wheel the Herbie Kirby.
My HOA fees pay to clean that up.
Dude, you've seen what my neighborhood's like. The Facebook people would be losing their mind. The only thing worse I could do than throw trash in the streets is let my dog poop in someone's yard.
Oh.
Because if that happens,
you would get ejected from the neighborhood.
No, but somebody will post nasty stuff on Facebook. They'll never say anything to me, ever. Yeah. I don't let my dog poop or pee in anyone's yard, but if I did, they would never say, Jason, why did you do this? They would instead say, some jerk, you know who you are, let your dog poop in my yard, and I think you're the most horrible person in the world.
Yeah,
I think you're a Nazi. I think you're a terrible person, and you deserve to be executed because you let your dog poop in my yard.
Passive-aggressive revenge posts on Facebook.
Right. Yeah, so the best is people have gotten so tired of it, people will start posting, hey, you could have stopped them and told them that, or hey, if you know who they are, why don't you just send them a message? Or hey, do anything else that's more useful than this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, hey, that's Facebook, man.
It's Facebook in the suburbs.
That's how it runs.
I'm rocking the suburbs. That's what's happening.
You love it. You're like in the suburb of the suburbs, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyways.
Yeah.
That is good stuff.
It's great stuff. I played a game.
Yeah.
I played Holmes, Sherlock, and Mycroft.
How was that?
That two-player game that I bought at Origins.
Yeah.
Man, that game's good, dude.
Good.
That game's good. You would like that game.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it's solid.
It gave me kind of a Mr. Jack vibe with the back and forth
the
board was set up.
It's totally different.
But I mean, like a strategic, like two-player, no? Still different?
Yeah, it's still pretty different. I mean, there's worker placement and set.
There's no dog in this one?
Actually, Toby is in this one.
No?
Yeah.
All right, well, there you go.
So it's just, Christine and I got about halfway through a game, and we're like, huh, I have all of those cards, and you have all of those cards, and there's no reason for me to get any of yours or you to get mine. We must be misunderstanding how the scoring works. And then we went back and read the rules a second time and realized, we were playing it super wrong.
Right.
Super, super wrong.
You know what you should have done?
What should we have
done? Then?
Yeah.
You should have, before figuring out that you were doing it wrong, you should have recorded a video review and just screamed and raged about how terrible the game was.
I should have done that.
And then figured it out and just not apologized.
Right.
That'd have been cool. You should do that. That's what I promote.
Uh-huh. Well, I like to think that I have some integrity. I mean, I'm not a game reviewer. You know, we go out of our way to say that so that we can make mistakes. And I mean, when we make mistakes,
we apologize.
We apologize for that. But
like we read the tweets that people send to us about how stupid we are.
Right. You know, and we try and share those sorts of things. Because I like to think that even though I'm not a game reviewer, I have some personal integrity as a person who talks into a microphone that people might listen to.
Yeah,
true. Try to be accountable.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's just us. So, yeah.
We're talking purely theoretical,
theoretical
stuff here.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that game is solid. Like real, real good. Sherlock Holmes, it's Holmes, Sherlock, and Watson. The name is hard to say. I don't like the name of that game.
That is a terrible name.
I would prefer that it was like called the Holmes Brothers or something, or Sherlock versus Mycroft, or
Sherlock versus Mycroft would be perfectly acceptable. It would tell you what the game is about,
right? Or
not be terrible,
you know, or even call it like, you know, the mystery : Sherlock versus Mycroft or something. But just I hate that name.
Or what is the official name?
Holmes, Sherlock, and Mycroft.
Why isn't it Sherlock versus Mycroft? That would actually make more sense.
Sure, that's what it... Yeah, but anyway, regardless, it's a great game. Really like that a lot. Probably right now while you're listening to this, I'm on vacation all this week. I've got a bunch of family in town. So probably while you're listening to this, I am either on a boat...
Or playing this game.
Or playing some game, yeah.
Yeah? Playing a game Heads and Tails.
Yeah. Good stuff. I was kind of hoping for an on a boat joke there, but you didn't laugh.
I was busy.
Yeah. Busy looking at your phone and not paying attention to me.
Well, I was trying to bring up something that I was going to talk about, but now I can't find it.
Well, getting back to Matchet Heads and Tails since you mentioned it. Yeah, my 3.5-year-old niece is visiting, and I don't have any kids games, so I'm borrowing Matchet Heads and Tails from Jason because he has kids games. And it looks like a pretty intense Euro. What you have to do is you have to look at the head of an animal, and then you have to put it next to a card that has that animal's butt on it. Which, you know, I'm down, man. I'm down with connecting heads to butts.
Heads to butts, it's the way you do it.
Yeah, talking to the microphone, please.
Heads to butts, it's the way you do it. So there was a Kickstarter that John Gilmore posted today.
Talking to the microphone, please.
There was a Kickstarter that... No, here it is. I found it. Okay, so this other person just is too dumb to link stuff, apparently. Okay, so there's...
John Gilmore's not dumb.
No, John Gilmore linked it correctly.
Oh, okay.
Somebody relinked it and then it didn't work. And that guy's probably not dumb, but he's bad at linking.
He did something wrong.
So anyways, it was posted by Curtis Clark. It's called White Text on Black Cards.
I wondered
and
if you bring this up.
I feel like this needs a shout out. He only has a goal of $2,500, and I encourage you to support him so that he makes it. I don't know that I'll buy a copy of the game.
I'm not going
to. But I may at least do the dollar pledge just to support it because I think it's funny. So this is White Text on Black Cards is the game you play. Well, where it is?
It's basically if somebody says, hey, I want to play Cards Against Humanity, you pull out this card and say, no.
And there's one card. It's the one black card that says, the reason I do not want to play any version, variant, expansion, official or otherwise, of any white text on black card game. And then there's 17 white cards that are in it. Things that talk about all the things in those games that are not funny,
mm-hmm.
that are not okay to talk about.
Like making jokes at other people's expense and yes. being offensive because it's funny to be offensive,
right.
which makes it not offensive.
Hey, yeah. Well,
you know, and
I liked was making a joke and then having to say and then having to apologize for it means you're a jerk.
Yeah. My favorite one was, what was it? It was reading another person's spreadsheet of jokes is not a joke.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a game, right?
Yeah, something like that. You know, I have a lot of respect for that dude for just doing that, for saying, I hate things that are fun, and I hate things that are not fun, and I'm just hateful in general, and I'm going to be hateful in public. You know, respect to you, dude, for being hateful in public and just basically giving a big middle finger to the Cards Against Humanity people. I will respect you for eternity for that. Good job. You know, come on. Don't crap on other people's fun, though. That's kind of a jerk thing to do.
It's kind of funny.
You know, it's fun. I think it's funny. Yeah.
I just think that, there have been so many variants. So Cards Against Humanity, I think, is not cool. I don't like the game.
Yeah,
I
mean, you never have.
But I mean, people want to play it. There's no problem. But like more and more, like, I've seen more and more on Kickstarter spin-offs of it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That are far more vulgar and far more offensive. And they're doing that because that's the only way to get attention with those games, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you made a game that has, like, it's not white text and black cards, but you have a game that's something like that.
Yeah.
But hey, it's fun and it plays not offensive.
It plays very differently.
You know?
It's not just apples to apples with a bad language, you know?
Right. You know, so it just, I don't know. Yeah. Anyways, I just say, hey, what's up to that guy?
Yeah. But yeah, hey, you know what? If you guys are interested in that, go for it. It's funny. It is funny.
And if you love Cards Against Humanity and you're offended by the fact that we don't like it, I'm sorry.
I feel like we've talked about that enough in our past that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. Unless you're a new builder. If you're a new builder and haven't listened to... well, actually, we probably haven't talked about that in more than a year.
Yeah.
So, we're done with CAH.
Most new builders, though, I know. New builders I know who come on board.
Yeah, they tend
to go back and listen to the back catalog.
That's true. And thank you for that. We appreciate that.
Yes.
Guys.
So,
Yeah, and Game of Thrones, man.
I wish that we
need to like have a spoiler cast bonus episode or something.
That would be awesome.
You know, where we can just talk about it. Because, man, that was good.
It was
good.
One of the best. My wife has been trying to dodge spoilers because we're watching it now from the beginning because she wants to catch up with it. Uh-huh. So I was just like, you know, I think you might like to say, let's watch the first season. It's 10 episodes. It's not a huge investment.
Yeah.
If you hate it, never watch it again. But I think you're going to love it. And we're on the second season now, and she is hooked.
She's hooked. Yeah, sure.
So our goal is, of course, to get caught up before the new season comes out, which will be no problem. It's only 49 more episodes we have. I mean, it's not hard.
Right.
So,
yeah. And for anybody out there who hasn't heard this before, I'm just gonna put this in your head, okay? I'm going to say, Dinklage, Peter Dinklage, Peter Dinklage, Peter Dinklage, Peter Peter, Peter Dinklage. Peter Dink. Anyway, that's enough.
Yeah.
There's a whole YouTube video of somebody singing that.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's the worst. Once it gets in your head, it gets in your head.
It's never going to go away.
So now I'm glad that you shared that with the builders so they can hate us forever.
You're welcome.
Remember, it's not my fault. This is Rob's fault.
You're welcome, builders. I love you guys.
So, all right, let's move on. Let's talk about a topic. Because after said topic, we've got a couple voicemails I want to play. So,
oh, great. Okay.
So we asked for topics today. So if you hate this topic, it's because if you hate this topic, you can think, let's pull it up and see. So the topic is, you know, I'm just going to read the whole thing as a tweet because I think that makes more sense.
You betcha.
And then they can totally blame this guy if they hate it.
Do that.
This is from Andrew Wilson at Silent77 Podcast BTG. I don't know why I read that part. Correlation between complexity and thematic depth. Can light games provide thematic experiences? And I thought that was interesting because we talk a lot about theme and mechanics and theme justified mechanics and all those things. So this just seemed like an interesting way to talk about it.
So can a light game be heavy on theme? Does that work? Can it have a deep theme with light mechanics?
And because we don't just want to answer a question.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Okay. Topic done. We should talk about it, but we should also flip that and say, can a big, bulky, complex game really, really pull you in without a theme?
Mm-hmm.
That probably seems like an obvious question, but we should ask it both ways.
Sure.
So let's talk about first what his actual question was, which was, can a light game have still really pull you into theme?
So do we need to classify light game?
Well, okay. Yes. Let's do that first. So light game, I would say
30 minutes or less.
Yeah. I mean, 30 minutes or less, I think, qualifies as a filler. So the question is, can filler games have themes that really pull you in?
That resonate.
Yes. Yeah. Resonate and change your life.
Sure. Yes. Right? Yes.
Yes.
Of course they can.
I think they can.
Of course they can. We talk a lot about mechanics justified by the theme, like you said. And absolutely. Absolutely. It's very possible. And the more you can connect theme and mechanics, the more success you're going to have in making that theme seem deep. But there are also ways to do that with things like flavor text on cards, you know,
right.
and good art and good design outside of the mechanical complexity of it. Theme is so heavily connected to the feeling of being a part of that experience that you're trying to simulate, you know?
Well, that's the thing is I feel like games that are simulating, like the theme that is simulating something, is more likely to draw you in, whether it's, I'm trying to remember, how long does it take to play Hostage Negotiator?
Oh, gosh, I think I played a game in 10 minutes, 15 maybe?
So that is a perfect example of a deep theme that stresses you the crap out while you're playing it.
Oh, yeah.
And that resonates afterwards, you know what I mean? You're looking at these cubes that you're losing, and they're cubes, right? Well, actually in the new version, they're meeples. Yeah. But sorry. In the original version, when I was playtesting it for AJ, they were cubes, right?
Yeah.
And, like, you're watching these cubes go away, and you're like, oh, gosh, those are people.
Those are people.
Crud.
Yeah.
And so that is a game that I've connected with thematically more than a lot of games, more than a lot of big, thicker games, you know, more than like a, like I know people talk about like Battlestar Galactica and stuff like that, where you get really involved in the theme, who's the traitor, all that, you know. I'm not dogging that game. I know people love it. But, you know, because of that, you know, that really pulls you in. But I think Hostage Negotiator does just as good of a job as really pulling you into that theme. Mm-hmm. I think that heavier themes obviously are going to pull you in more than non-heavy themes, right?
Yeah, sure.
So Hostage Negotiator is honestly probably the best example we're going to come up with off the top of our heads.
It's
of a
pretty
light
solid
game,
yeah.
That has a theme that is so heavy and doesn't, but everything is theme justified. I mean, that's something that's always been very important to AJ in general, is justifying everything to the theme,
right?
And you know, he's concerned about that, which I respect because I'm concerned about that. So I think that is, you know, I think you could have, and this very well may exist. I haven't played it, but I have Bear Valley, mm-hmm. which I believe plays in 15 to 30 minutes.
Okay.
And that is a survival game where you're running. I hope, I haven't played it, so I don't know, but I hope that, the theme, it really pulls you in and really, gets you, cause it's about survival, which mm-hmm. to me should feel pretty, pretty intense, mm-hmm. right? If done correctly. So hopefully.
Yeah. And the one I mentioned before, Holmes, Sherlock and Watson,
Minecraft.
I mean, gosh. Yeah. See, that's the other thing. I want to say Sherlock and Watson, you know,
cause Sherlock and Watson wouldn't be competing.
I know that's the thing. It's just, God, the name is terrible. That is a game.
Why does Mycroft have to be so smart too?
Well, because he is.
It's just kind of lame that Mycroft also super genius.
Well, he is though.
But Sherlock is smarter, right?
Oh no. Uh-uh. No, they're pretty much on par with each other.
That's dumb.
Yeah. Well,
you know what that is?
What's that?
That's Iron Man.
Talk to me,
and
Jason.
Everybody constantly gets Iron Man powers, right?
Uh-huh.
Like that's the only thing I don't like about the Iron Man movies is everyone has Stark Tech for the first like two movies. Like that's the whole thing. It was more Stark Tech.
Yeah.
Or they make stuff out of Stark Tech.
Yeah, well, I mean, you need somebody to compete. In order to be really dangerous, you need somebody that's as smart or smarter than your hero.
Well, but you could also have one that's different. I mean, Superman, right? Classic hero, right? Uh-huh. Who's his villain?
Well, Lex Luthor.
Because he's super strong? No, because he's super smart. Right.
Well, I mean, he's the villain in the movies. You know, I mean, right. not in most of the comics. Anyway, we don't need to argue with that, right? So, where was I going? So, Sherlock and Mycroft. Almost said Sherlock and Watson again. that is a game that it's a light game, but thematically, I think a lot of people could say that thematically that has some depth to it, but. I don't feel like it would be hard to re-theme that and make it pretty seamless.
Right.
You know?
In fact, then you could probably give it a good title.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It'd be easy to re-theme, I think, is what I'm saying. You know? Yeah, I don't know. So we're beating a dead horse here, so let's swap to that other...
Yeah. So
can a complex... Well, heavy game work without a strong theme?
Well, so I think the answer is, in general, yes, only because, well, depends on how you define complex and heavy.
Yeah.
Because a lot of Euros, which are complex and heavy, have mm-hmm. the same boring theme, which is medieval times, trading and stuff.
Yeah, so I think... I think it's so the advantage that a light game has there is that it's a light game and a lot more people are going to have patience to try it. Whether it's got a heavy, strong theme or a real light one, it's going to be a lot more approachable for a lot of people. Whereas a bigger game, if we're saying a light game is 30 minutes, if we're talking about a heavier game that's, you know, 60 minutes plus, that's a much bigger time commitment, just kind of on that surface level. And there's going to be more people who say, that doesn't look really interesting to me. I'd rather play something short. Or, you know, we've talked before about I don't like to get into real long games because I'd rather play more games in the same amount of time than focus on one or two.
Right.
So I think depending on the audience, a big game, a heavier game, heavier Euro or something, can get away with a kind of a generic or passive theme. They can get away with it, but it's a little bit... I don't know. I think that they're more dependent on a strong, deep theme to try and hook people. And the bigger the game is, the more important that is, in my opinion.
Right.
You know, I like Catan. Catan, I've played Catan maybe twice ever.
Uh-huh.
And it was fun, you know?
Right.
And I'll play it again at some point if somebody wants to play Catan. But it, trading the Mediterranean is like...
Right.
There's nothing about that theme that excites me and makes me want to go and play that. And there's nothing about that theme that makes me feel like I'm really doing that.
Right.
You know,
honestly, when I think about Catan, because it's a game I used to play literally every week.
Yeah.
It was only because of the people we played it with. Anytime I had to play it with somebody else, it was like, this is boring. Yeah. I don't want to deal with this.
Sure.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. Trying to think about any lessons learned from Saloon Tycoon on that. For a time, we toyed with the idea of maybe retheming it as a pirate game.
Uh-huh.
You know, as building a port town, Port Royale, or something like that. You know, or a pirate village, in building your little shopping center for pirates, and I mean, we could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it would have been hard to do. And I think it could have still had a lot of the same thematic feeling and excitement to it. But I think if you played that game as an abstract experience, it would not be fun.
I agree.
So I think it could mechanically be exactly the same game, but if you're just playing it strictly as a mechanical thought.
I'm going to build another thing.
Yes, I'm building the tower, and the tower is there to earn me points. And by I'm going to assign tower ABX, I'm going to choose tile ABX, and by connecting that to tile CL3, by combining the two of those together, then I'm going to be able to achieve these bonus points for victory. And that's super boring, and there's nothing in that that's going to make me want to come back and play that again.
Right. The other thing is, it would be super hard to learn that game.
Well, yeah.
Because that's the other thing, is when you're dealing with, anytime you're going to deal with a game with a theme like that, you need to have the theme justified mechanics, right? Because that is what makes it easy to remember. That's what makes it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
it's the opposite of fiddly, right?
Yeah.
Is when you can say, oh, the theme would tell me that probably.
Sure.
How does this work out? Well, probably like this. Hey, look, because that's what the theme said. So,
sure. Yeah, whereas when we played Tausch Rausch, I mean, that game doesn't have a theme. It doesn't need a theme. It needs numbers on cards.
Right.
And sometimes, and there are also funny faces on the cards, but they're just there to fill an empty white space, you know? So it doesn't need a fancy theme, because mechanically it's just not important.
Right.
You know? And putting a theme onto it certainly wouldn't hurt it, but I nor would it help.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, I don't know. Any final thoughts on that?
I actually thought Tausch Rausch, putting a theme on it could hurt it, actually.
You think?
Because if you put a theme on it that wasn't approachable or didn't feel fun, it could actually make it less fun than just having funny faces on it. So,
well, I mean, if it's seal clubbing the card game, well, of course. But I mean, you could say that about anything.
Okay, fair enough. I meant if it was suddenly a game about, like, if I saw Tausch Rausch, but instead of being called Tausch Rausch, it was called like Trading in the Mediterranean, the card game.
Mm-hmm.
I would not play it. But I hear Tausch Rausch. I get that it's a German name and it actually means something. I have no idea what it means.
No, I don't know either.
But it rhymes, so you know that's enough for me to think it's cool. Mm-hmm. So
actually, honestly, if that was put with a Catan theme on it, it would probably do real well.
It would, but if with a Catan theme, I would probably try it.
Yeah.
But I'm saying if it was just like a standard like Euro style theme, that would make it lame to me.
I'd be less inclined. It certainly wouldn't stand out to me. Yeah.
Right. The simple but fun artwork stands out to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it also helps that Kopac was like, this game is fantastic. So I believed him because he's smart.
Right.
And then he was right. And the game was fantastic.
So
Rob, you're going to pitch a game, right?
I am going to pitch a game. So I can't remember if I ever, 2 years ago, Christine and I took a trip to the UK, went to Scotland and England.
You've talked about that a lot.
Yeah, right. So I'm not going to review that trip in a lot of detail, but what I can't remember is, did I ever pitch a game on the show about Mary King's Close
The thing that they was underneath everything.
Yeah.
And they locked all the people in and they died or something.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, not die. Well, yeah. Okay. Sure. All right.
We talked about that.
Yeah. Sure. So that's something that's thematically, I love that story. If anybody's not familiar, I'm not going to waste your time and rehash the whole history of that.
Check it out. It is interesting. It's very interesting.
Read about the history of Edinburgh in Scotland on Wikipedia, and about Mary King's Close, and the short version, because I need to make sure that people understand what I'm presenting here.
Oh yeah, of course.
The short version is that there was in medieval Scotland, in medieval Edinburgh, there was this. The main road that led up to the castle, and that was called High Street. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And it was this long sloping thing. And at the end of High Street was the big rocky outcropping where the castle is, Edinburgh Castle. And then the ground sloped steeply away from that on both sides of High Street. Okay. And in medieval Scotland, we're talking 1600s here. The population density was, they wanted to keep everybody within the walled city, and so they had to build homes and houses and structures very, very densely packed with right. next to each other. And so they would build these houses, and they would build them running running down the hill, basically, so that there would be one house at the top of the hill that's along High Street, and then they would kind of go down the hill, and the houses at the bottom of the street would be up against the lock, or the swamp near the lock.
Uh-huh.
Right. Okay. And between these houses, these big row houses or tenement buildings, right. They'd be very, very tall. They could be 6 or 7 stories tall,
mm-hmm.
In various places. And these hills are very, very steep. So we're talking about streets in between these building, these rows, that run at, probably, 30 to 35 degree angle. I mean, this is,
right.
Really, really steep. And in, and this is medieval times, in the winter, for example, these places, there's no plumbing, right? There's no electricity. There's,
right, right.
At best, there might be gas lamps, but even mm-hmm. back at this time, probably not. This is long before the Victorian era when they had gas lamps. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, there was no plumbing. So people would just, they would do their business in buckets and pour it out the window. And in the winter, people would pour all that stuff out. And the people who lived on the bottom floors, sometimes their homes would get flooded. And in the winter, it would all freeze. And those steep slopes of roads would become basically chutes. And if you slipped and fell, you would slide all the way down a literal ice slide of human excrement. All the way down to the bottom and into the frozen, polluted, gross lock.
I really laugh because it sounds so terrifying.
It's terrible, right. And they are horrible, filthy places. The poorer you were, the lower down you lived, the closer to the street you lived.
Uh-huh.
And then because of the density, some of them streets were, wide enough to fit a cart down, so maybe 8-10 feet wide.
Right.
But it was more common for some of them to be 4 feet wide or
just
even
enough to walk.
Just enough to walk. Two people couldn't walk side by side down these
right.
things. Really, really narrow and dense. And then in the Victorian era, they decided to that they wanted to just get rid of all this stuff, and they wanted to rebuild a new city on top of Edinburgh. So basically all they did is they just chopped them all off at the High Street level and then just flattened all that out and built a bunch of new buildings on top of that.
Right.
And then in the 60s, archaeologists broke back into these ruins, the foundations, and found an entire city that had just been abandoned underground.
Right.
That was still perfectly preserved. Amazing history. Anyway, okay. So I've been fascinated by that piece of history, and I tried to pitch a game based on that before, and it just didn't work for me. So I'm coming back to it today to try and approach that. This is a tile placement game. Also has worker placement and some set collection to it.
Okay.
Okay. So we start with the game board, and the game board has a grid on it, and the grid is kind of like a cross section, or if we're kind of looking straight on at a slope. Okay. So on the board, you would see that there's a grid. The grid is call it 6x8. Okay.
Okay.
6x8 grid. All right. Except the bottom corner is chopped off at an angle. Okay. So it stair steps down on this grid. Okay.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Right. So on the far right hand side is the highest point where it's been chopped off. That side equals the top of the hill at High Street. Okay. And then the left-hand side is the bottom of that slope, and that is where the lock is. Okay.
Okay.
So we've got a four-sided thing, but the bottom is cocked up at an angle, or, you know, was chopped off.
Right.
Okay. And actually there's some stair stepping at the top there because not all the roofs were level. So we got a total of, it was 26 squares.
Okay.
27. Remember, okay. Okay. So 27 squares in this grid, and it's not a perfect grid. They're all kind of stair stepped around. Okay. Every player is going to get 3 meeples. Those are your workers. Those are your guys you can send out into the city to do stuff for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There is then a stack of tiles that have been shuffled, and each of these tiles is basically the floor of a building that's going to be built in this row, okay, along this close.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, those alleys are called closes.
Right, that makes sense.
Because the buildings are so close together.
Right.
So at the start of the game, you're going to shuffle up that stack of tiles, of rooms, and then you're going to put 3 face up, and the rest are going to stay in a stack face down. All right, everybody gets their 3 meeples, and then everybody starts a game with a couple of gold. There are 4 resources in the game. There's gold, which, you know, so money, currency, right? There are textiles, tools, and food.
Okay.
So textiles, tools, and food are products, are resources that are going to be created in the shops and in the workshops and in the homes and things in the rooms that you're building.
Okay.
Okay. So on your turn, you are going to place your workers. I should say also outside of where you're going to be building these rooms,
mm-hmm.
There are other places where you can assign your workers. So you can assign one worker to call it the planning office. I don't know what it would be. We'll call it the planning office. And that's, if you're going to put a guy there, then you're going to take a tile.
Okay.
Okay. If you take a face down tile from top of the stack, it's free. But if you want to take one of the tiles that's face up, that's going to cost you 4 gold.
Okay, because you're picking and choosing then.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Now, then there's also the market. And if you go to the market, you can spend gold to buy resources. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's 2 gold for 1 resource.
Okay.
Okay. All right. And again, food, textiles, tools.
Right.
All right. Okay. There's also on the side a set of gold cards. Okay. And the gold cards are going to be a thing where you have to exchange a set of resource cubes to claim that gold card. And that gold card is going to have a victory point value on it. And then it's also going to have some kind of a special icon on it. And there are 5 different icons that could be on those. That's going to help you with set collection. All right. And we're going to say that side of the card is white. If you were to flip the gold card over, it would be the exact same card, but it would be a black background instead of a white background. I'm going to come back to that. Okay. So on your turn, you're going to assign your workers and do some kind of thing. And if you're going to draw a tile, then you take that tile and you place it somewhere on the grid. Has to be on the ground. You can't build a room in midair, you know. Has to be on top of,
right.
You know. So
that makes sense.
So the first ones, of course, have to be along the bottom of that grid somewhere, as in they're put on the ground floor. That tile then becomes a new worker spot. Okay. So any tiles that are placed there, every tile that comes down is going to give you some other option for you to assign a worker to.
Okay.
And as we go around the room, around the table, everyone places one worker and then does that action. Then you place your next worker and do that action and place your third worker and do that action.
Okay.
And then that turns over and you continue from there replacing your workers. You cannot reassign a worker to the same spot. So you always have to move somebody to a new spot every time. Okay. And you cannot have more than one worker on the same spot of your worker on the same spot, unless they're going to the market. As many people can go to the market as want. I should say market and the planning office. You can send as many people there as you want. But when it comes to actually going to visit individual shops along the close, you can only send one guy there. If there are 4 players, all 4 players could send one guy to the same place, but you can't send 2 guys to the same place in the close.
Okay.
So things that your workers are going to do in the shops. All of the shop tiles have a kind of a standard value of 2 resources. So if you put a guy there to a place where that makes tools, you're going to get 2 tool cubes. Same thing with tiles or textiles. Same thing with food. Okay. There are some places that will allow you to get one tool and 1 textile or whatever, some combination thereof. There's also a place where you can go to earn 4 gold. Okay. Or there might be a place where you can go to get one tool and two gold or something like that. Okay. So you're just going to kind of get whatever you want. But what is available is going to depend on what people choose and place, right? There are also things that allow you to manipulate things like, you know, maybe you can trade resources for other things. It just other ways to kind of tweak stuff, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, the thing is, though, if ever a round ends after everyone's placed all of their workers, all three of their workers, if ever there's a situation where a tile is face up and no one puts a worker there, that means that shop is not getting any business more and it's abandoned. You flip it over and it becomes a slum.
Oh.
And it's gone for good.
So that's going to happen a lot, right?
It's going to happen a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to happen a lot. Now, keep in mind, if you're playing a four-player game, that's 12 workers that are out there doing stuff.
And you can't double up?
You can't double up with your workers, but other players can double up. So
I could put three workers on one location.
No.
Oh, see, okay. You can put a worker on my location.
Right.
I can't put two workers of mine on the same location.
Right.
Okay. So you still could have not 12 spaces filled. You could have, theoretically, if everybody was doing the same thing, you could have three spaces filled.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So as soon as that's been abandoned for a full round, that it goes out of business, it's flipped over, it becomes a slum. Okay. And you're continuing to play as things go, and claiming gold cards to get victory points. I won't go through the list of all the different worker actions that I've come up with.
Of course, right.
And I want to come up with one thing I'm struggling with is because I want placement on that grid to matter.
Uh-huh.
So I'm trying to think more about things that have actions that are dependent upon, you know, where it is in the elevation or in relation to the screed or in relation to the lock. That's right. Really kind of what I'm working on right now.
Right.
So at some point, though, you're going to be claiming gold cards. There are five possible icons that are on those gold cards.
Uh-huh.
One of them is the Plague Doctor. Okay. You know that I like the Plague Doctor image, right?
I know you love the
Plague
Doctor.
Okay. So when the third Plague Doctor gold card is claimed,
uh-huh,
then the plague hits Edinburgh.
Okay.
Okay. And then those gold cards flip over to the black side.
Okay.
Okay. So now anything you claim is going to be a black card instead of a white card. All still the same goals and still the same points. Theoretically, that's going to then drive more of the set collection stuff for endgame scoring. Okay. And you're going to want to get sets of the same icons in black and white and get multipliers and things like that. So,
makes sense,
that's going to drive all the endgame scoring.
Okay.
I think the game ends either probably when the last goal card is drawn or when the last tile is drawn.
Okay.
And there are going to be more tiles than there are spaces because theoretically you could knock it. There's going to be an ability to remove a tile from the board and replace it with something.
Okay.
So I'm thinking probably it's going to be when all the gold cards are claimed. That's when the game ends.
Makes sense.
But we'll see how that goes. That end game is a little fuzzy for me.
Right.
So that's basically the whole game.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah. So, it's got worker placement, tile placement, set collection, and that little changeover moment, which is all of my favorite things. And I feel like I've kind of finally got something here. This is kind of the first time since Saloon Tycoon that I feel like I've got something, kind of a Euro style thing that's a little bigger that I'm really kind of excited about.
And you feel good about it.
I feel good about it. I think
it sounds interesting.
I'm definitely ready to prototype it and just start pushing some stuff around and see what works and what doesn't.
See if you can make it work out.
Yeah. So, I'm calling it Edinburgh 1645 because that's when the plague hit, but I'm not sure if that's the best name for it. I want to actually have a name for the close that you're building on, but I don't want to just pick the name of a real one. I kind of want it to be my fictional close.
Right.
So we'll see.
Rob Couch is close.
Builder's close.
Nice. So, I would try that. That sounds interesting.
Any thoughts, any questions, any confusions?
So how far into the game in general would you be shooting for the changeover to happen?
I would like it to happen either, you know, between one third of the way and two thirds of the way through.
And would you stack the deck to make that happen somehow?
I would need to make sure that those Plague Doctor icons are frequent enough in there. That's another thing I have to decide is how many of those gold cards that I haven't made those yet.
Right.
You know, how many of those am I going to have? What are the different potential combos? I was thinking five icons because I was thinking there'd be the four humors that I've talked about before as well. Gosh, and then the Plague Doctor. And this I like this. And this is one of the things I like it is that it allows me to put in all these little tiny thematic hooks that I've liked so much in the past.
Right.
Maybe that's too many icons. I don't know.
So that'd be the trick. I mean,
I think it's either got to be five or three icons.
Right. Yeah. That was my biggest thought, was wondering that, you know, when that happens, and the idea that what happens when you end up with just tons of slums and people's actions get super limited.
Yeah.
That might not be an issue. That might only happen if people are like Cape Guy in it, right?
Yeah, well, in there could be a class of... Well, so it would probably make sense with some of those rooms, like if they're tied to location, maybe they don't flip. Maybe they're good forever.
Right.
You know? Because then, you know, if you put it there and then nobody uses it, then filling that slot was a waste.
Right. It'd be interesting, too, to see if people would purposely be taking things that were not helpful to them, knowing that they can't let it flip.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the last guy to go, darn it, I can't let this flip because I know at some point I'm going to need it, but I don't need it right now, but I guess I'll just use it because I don't want it to flip.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting. I think that could be some interesting strategy. So
yeah, but I don't think I've seen a worker placement game before where the worker options, if you don't use them, they go away.
No, I don't think I have either. I like that.
Yeah.
So, and thematically it makes sense.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Use it or lose it, you know? If you don't patron if you don't spend money at the establishment, then you're not going to, that establishment is going to go out of business.
Right.
Yeah. So, and also then I want something that would be, give you some kind of a bonus or a special ability if it's surrounded by slums.
Right.
You know?
That is cool, yeah.
So, something on the ground floor, something on the top floor, so on.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that sounds good. I think it's a good idea to prototype that one.
Yeah, so I think it's
worthwhile.
That's something. Hopefully my first version of that will be good enough for me to revise and take to Gen Con. I really wanted to have something a little heavier that I could take with me to Gen Con to do some testing.
Yeah, it's a good place for it. So.
Yeah, so. And I won't have an opportunity like that again. I mean, after Grand Con, kind of a little bit, but...
But that's not as... I mean, you won't get as many plays in.
Yeah.
There's more time to get plays in, but there's not as many people. So it's a little harder to get more plays
in.
So.
And I'm thinking, you know, I realistically need to be looking forward to Unpup, right?
Right.
Because, you know, I want to have something that I'm developing right now so that by the time I get to Unpub, I can try and put it through final testing, you know, instead of first testing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So
cool.
There we go.
All right.
Okay. You have a voicemail?
You know what? Next episode, I realize we have a couple voicemails and some Twitter questions and stuff. Why don't we just save those all for next episode and use that as our topic since we don't have a topic?
Sure. We can do that.
So, yeah. So let's do that then.
Okay. We'll close it up here then. Well, before we wrap up the show, I want to say congratulations again to Michael for winning our football dice game challenge. And congratulations on becoming our judge for the Iron Design Challenge at Gen Con. We're looking forward to seeing you there. Hopefully you'll be able to make it. And builders, if you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @podcastbtg. Jason is @JASlingerlin, and I am @poorly_designed. Like us on Facebook. Give us a 5-star review on all of the podcast places. Call our Google Voice number at 770-TEL-BTG. Our website is buildingthegamepodcast.com. Buy Water Balloon Washout. Go to the Game Crafter and buy Finish It or the Rumplebum Academy for bug-based baking. And we'll do this again next week. Thanks a lot.
Indeed we will.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios. All of the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are property of the Building the Game podcast. Next time on Building the Game.
Somebody said, how about you talk about math behind games? How do you know when a design with a game should have 3 cards or 4 cards to start or 5 cards face up or 4 cards face up? What's the difference there? I feel like there could be something there, but I also feel like we might run out of things to talk about.
We're not smart enough to handle that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.